Republican informer for the Gardaí, was murdered in Kerry by the IRA in 1985. No one has ever been charged for the crime. His special branch handler was a Garda from Finnish, J.P. O'Sullivan. Now retired, J.P. has written a book called Veil of Silence, where he says not enough was done to save John Corcoran and wants an inquiry into how senior Garda leadership handled the issue. Jerry spoke to J.P. this week and first asked him, why did he write the book?
Fundamentally for me, Jerry, it has always been a matter of conscience. And the question was always when I would write it and never if. In reality, the book has been in the making for a number of years, a few years. In the meantime, the protagonists have become fewer in number. Also, from my own point of view, I have a good bit of mileage on the clock. Thank God we're still going fine. There's no serious mechanical problems. But as you know, time and tide wait for no man or no woman. So I decided it had to be done. And that's how it transpired. Now is the time. And I'm delighted I've got it out with the assistance of Merrion Press. And then may I thank you and Radio Kerry in advance for giving me the opportunity to make the story public in the hope that truth will prevail down the line.
Take me back to the start then. You got involved early enough in your Garda career. You were in Templemore in 66. By 71, you were special branch and you were thrown headlong, I'd imagine, into that, I suppose, clandestine subversive war against the IRA and all that was happening in Northern Ireland and its support operations here in the South.
Yes, I mean, in those days, and I think it's generally acknowledged now, Jerry, that this state was under threat, particularly in the early 70s. The threat was no longer England. It was threat from the Provisional IRA, from the INLA, and whoever else you get to throw into that mix. And particularly after the demonstrations in the north of Ireland, Bloody Sunday, etc., the floodgates opened as far as we were concerned. A lot of new heads started coming into the IRA. At that stage in 1971, I was drafted in to assist. I did this with another newcomer to the branch at the same time, and we joined another comrade who was already in there.
Okay.
And we took it from there. That was 71.
And that brought you into contact. What you had to do was to, I suppose, ferret out, to try and work out how the operations worked south of the border, who was overtly a member of the IRA, who was an active service member unit, who was intelligence, who was in support networks. And that's how you come across John Corcoran. You managed to, as the phrase is, meet him, sit him down, and eventually turn him to work for the Irish state as an informant.
Yes, I mean, our function was, very briefly, was to identify and supervise members of subversive organisations. In that context, John Corcoran came within our radar, so to speak, in 1975. He was frequenting certain places, which led us to believe he knew something about what was going on in the Provisional IRA. We decided that he was probably an intelligence officer for that organisation. So we decided to approach him. There were three of us initially in the unit who decided to approach him. We arrested him under Section 30, took him to the Bridewell in Cork, and treated him with courtesy and went easy on him, so to speak. We discovered fairly quickly that John was opposed to armed action and conflict in the south of Ireland, in the Republic, and his main concentration or interest was in the north of Ireland and the activities of the Provisional IRA in that area. So we saw an opportunity in that to communicate with him, to build up, I suppose, a small element of trust, which happened between him and me. I spent long hours when he was in the Bridewell talking through that situation with him, and eventually We did develop a bit of trust, and we decided we'd release him on a friendly basis, which we did. That was the first encounter with John. Now, subsequently, we had to go back to him. We decided on the second occasion it was going to be make or break. There was no missing, no in between. So one evening, as he left work, we intercepted him. Two of us got into the car with him, and we drove to a quiet, secluded spot and did very little talking. We told him very straight and very quickly that our instructions were to have him arrested and to charge him in the Special Criminal Court with membership of the IRA. We told him the reasons for that. We told him who he was had been meeting. He didn't deny any of it. It sank in very quickly, and he started to talk and tell us some little things of not great consequence. But the principle was he was talking, and he was telling us something. And I think we had crossed the line. He had crossed the line, at least with us. And on that basis, again in a friendly atmosphere, we let him go. That was the start of it.
Okay, and you started working with him then on what was happening within the IRA and using that information. When then did you become concerned about him? You had raised concerns, I know, was it in September of 84 with your superiors about fearing for his safety?
Yes. And he brought some good information, and that increased, and the volume increased, and the frequency increased over the couple of years. Now, Don Tidy was kidnapped, and this really brought it to a head. And there was a fellow named Mick Burke from Cork, who was a member of the IRA, whom I add very quickly, was arrested, charged, and sent to prison for that offence. Okay? So I was actually trailing Mick Burke through John Corcoran. John knew him. He knew Sean O'Callaghan at that stage. He was liaising with both of them. O'Callaghan was coming to Cork. He was meeting John, and John was actually driving him from A to B and gaining his confidence all the time. And on the 1st of February 1984, I submitted a written report to C3, which is was the Security Intelligence Branch, and then directly to Assistant Commissioner Fanning, who was the man in charge. And in the course of that report, I think I made about 6 or 7 points. I referred to the possibility that I would be able to track down and arrest Burke. I was developing news on safe houses, both in West Cork and in Kerry and in Tralee. And I regarded that Burke was hiding in Tralee at that stage. And I wanted advice from my superiors about the weight of evidence that might be called against Burke in the event of his arrest. I also highlighted the danger, as I saw it, to John Corcoran, to my informant, if certain safe houses were searched and Burke was arrested. I sent that off. I got no reply from C3. I queried it twice in writing to C3, back to Fanning, still no reply. That was very, very strange. It sounded extraordinary to me. I mean, the state had become under threat, so to speak, from subversive organizations through the kidnap of Don Tidy. Had been murder, and there had been a serious attack on the state. I was getting close to Mick Burke. I could not understand why the Garda authorities had not responded to my reasonable questions and to the fears that I've raised.
Yeah, and that's where your concern stems from now. And then we go on to March, when the last time you spoke to John Cork, he told you he was on the way to do a job, on a job is what he used to term it. In March of that year, in 85, into Kerry. And that's the last time you saw him or spoke to him.
Yes, slightly before that. Now, Mick Burke was arrested in August of the same of 84. He actually walked into Tralee Garda Station and handed himself up. Okay, that happened in August. Fast forward to September, the following month, I got information from John Corcoran, which on the face of it seemed extraordinary. He said that Burke's arrest had actually been organised by Sean O'Callaghan, who was a member of the IRA from Tralee, and that for that purpose that Sean O'Callaghan had received information, inside information, from a Garda contact, you know, to help in that process. So that, to me, seemed fairly extraordinary information. Within hours, I had reported that in writing on the 4th of September back to Garda headquarters.
Yeah.
Now, that in effect, to translate that into plain, simple language, Jerry, that in effect meant that a member of the IRA, another member of the IRA, namely John Corcoran, now knew or at least suspected that Sean O'Callaghan was a Garda informant.
Yeah.
That in turn led to another scenario. If another member of the IRA knew that Sean O'Callaghan was a Garda informant or suspected that he was, that put two lives in danger. It put Sean O'Callaghan's security and cover as a Garda informant in serious danger. Number two, it also put John Corcoran's life in danger, he being the only other member of the IRA who actually knew or suspected that O'Callaghan was an informant. It worked both ways there from that point. Okay. Now, I reported that again to headquarters. I got no reply. Silence prevailed again. I think, in my opinion, from that point onwards, O'Callaghan took over, and John Corcoran's life his days were numbered from that point onward.
And that's what happened. He was taken to Kerry in March of 85 and executed.
He was
Kerry gated and executed.
The last time I spoke to him, I think, was on the 19th of March in 85. He said he was travelling to Kerry. And that in code, I mean, we understood each other. That in code meant I knew what he was doing. I had a good idea of the people he was going to meet on there because he had been there before. So there was no cause for alarm. As far as I was concerned at that stage, it was normal practice for him. Yeah. And he was to contact me the following day or whenever he got a chance. That was the procedure.
So how did you feel then, JP, when he went missing? It was 4 days before his body was found, and when the news came through that he had been killed.
The following day, when he hadn't contacted me, I got a bit alarmed. So I telephoned his work, which was the agreed procedure. And I used the code name Peter because we both agreed if one had to contact the other, we would use the name Peter. So there would be identification straight away. He hadn't been at work that day. I telephoned his home number, which I had, and I spoke to a lady who I presumed was his wife. And she told me he had been missing since the 19th, hadn't come home, had not come home. So I had been off duty from the 19th to the, I think, the 24th. I was off for a period of 5 days, but I was at home. Okay. And he was reported, his body was found a couple of days later after he was reported missing. I still had no contact from anybody at work. Now, to answer your question, when I heard of the news of his death, and I think it was on the Saturday, I was shocked. I mean, I had feared it because there had been no contact with him in the previous 2 days, but I was still shocked to my core when I heard that he had been shot and his body had been dumped in Ballincollig.
Jerry speaking there to J.P. O'Sullivan from Phoenix, a retired Garda who worked in the special branch, author of Veil of Silence, How the Irish State Covered Up an IRA Murder and Framed a Garda Whistleblower. We'll bring you part two after these. Before the break, you heard there Jerry's interview with a retired Garda from Phoenix, originally J.P. O'Sullivan, who worked in the special branch. Now retired, he's written a book called Veil of Silence, where he says not enough was done to save a Republican informer for the Garda Síochána, John Corcoran, who was murdered in Kerry by the IRA in 1985. J.P. O'Sullivan wants an inquiry into how senior Garda's leadership handled the issue. We continue Jerry's interview with J.P. O'Sullivan.
And from that point on, then your concerns obviously grew about what had happened, the lack of response from C3 and headquarters, and the fact that he had been killed. And that fed through, I'd imagine, to, as you say in the book, the murder investigation, which was conducted, that you feel was deeply unsatisfactory. And that's why you still have these questions to this day about what happened and why it was allowed to happen in that way.
Yeah, I mean, the cardinal rule of any serious Garda investigation, and particularly a murder investigation, and particularly more so where a Garda informant was the victim of a murder, the first thing to do, now the murder squad, as we call them, arrived in Cork shortly after his body was found. They would have taken charge, complete charge at that stage.
Yeah.
And the local Garda officers and teams would be subject to their direction. Now, the first thing, the cardinal rule would be to establish, number one, who had contacted this man last, who spoke to him last, and to bring him in and talk to him. That being me or one of my colleagues as well. Okay, nothing happened. I sat at home by the phone for days on end, waiting for that call from the murder squad. It did not come. It never arrived. I was ignored.
You went to Dublin. You contacted Deputy Commissioner McMahon at the Phoenix Park. You met him and you communicated all this. You were unhappy with what had happened, shocked about it, and also disillusioned with the investigation as well.
Yeah, I mean, eventually, after, I think, on the 24th, I was contacted by my detective superintendent, McMahon, from Union Quay, and asked him why I hadn't been contacted, why the murder squad had not contacted me. He said he had been on leave, he was away, and he simply did not know the answer. At that stage, and immediately, I submitted a detailed written report to him about what I knew about John Corcoran's last movements, his association with me, what he had said to me, where he was going, and submitted that in writing. And I mean, that was another reason. I also had visual evidence. I had a visual sighting of a suspect for the murder, a northern individual, a high-ranking individual, allegedly, had been sent down to Cork as part of a test for John, obviously. I discovered all this in hindsight from reading Sean O'Callaghan's book. So I was completely disillusioned. I knew there was something seriously wrong, but I couldn't put my finger on it. I had no way of knowing at that stage.
Yeah.
So I decided to telephone Deputy Commissioner McMahon. Now, one of my colleagues, had already spoken to Mr. McMahon in the previous years about difficulties that we had with my superiors in Cork. He was conversant with the situation. He knew what was going on. He had it in black and white in front of him, in fact. So I went to see him, met him in his office, and I tried to make known my feelings and my misgivings and my worries about the investigation and about how it was not proceeding according to regulations.
Yeah. And you feel you were stonewalled, to paraphrase it, JP.
You've taken the word out of my mouth. He stonewalled me completely. I got no satisfaction. He did give me his telephone number. At that stage, to be perfectly honest, I decided that I was so disillusioned and so disgusted with what had been going on and the lack of activity. And I felt I was being betrayed as a member of the Garda Síochána, and the trust in me was gone. I'd fought against the IRA for a number of years. I felt that all this had been disregarded completely. And here I was being stonewalled by the deputy commissioner. I decided I was going to resign from the force. And I told him that, and I asked him to convey that message to the commissioner. Now, I contacted him three times by phone afterwards on different dates that I noted in my diary.
Yeah.
I got answers that were negligent, had no information, stonewall, stonewall, stonewall. So I decided I'd go to my solicitor. He drafted a letter to me, which I sent to the commissioner, a letter of resignation, under specific terms. I submitted that in writing, and immediately I got a response from the commissioner to come and see him. I did that, went to travel to Dublin to see the commissioner. Not alone did I see the commissioner, I got three for the price of one.
Yeah, you got the deputy commissioner, assistant commissioner as well. And again, more stonewalling. Just from that point on, JP, I know there's difficulties from you within your career. You were suspended from the Gardaí, and obviously it went nowhere in terms of what you wanted them to do in terms of inquiry or investigation or proper explanation as the circumstances around the lack of action, as you saw it, around John Corcoran's disappearance and death.
No. Nothing. I mean, things went on from there. I went back to work. My resignation, which I had handed to the commissioner in writing, and my visit to headquarters, he rejected my application to resign. Yeah. He actually pushed the copy of my application back across his desk to me.
Yeah,
and he did advise me to, quite cynically, I thought with hindsight, to consult somebody in the government about it, which I did eventually. I went to see that. I spoke to the Tánaiste, Dick Spring, eventually about it.
Yeah.
And that also brought a negative result. No offence to, or no fault of Dick Springs, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I know, and it was something Dick Spring raised several times over years subsequently to that. He raised it in 1989 with the then Minister for Justice Michael Noonan, who himself had raised it in opposition. This has been well covered and well queried.
Yeah.
For decades, the John Corcoran murder, the circumstances to Sean O'Callaghan, what the Gardaí at headquarters knew, what, you know, was it to protect one informant for the other? And you know, despite promises of inquiries, one has never happened. Is that what you want now, JP? A proper inquiry, even though all these years have passed by, a proper inquiry into what happened?
I mean, it's never too late. It is late at this stage, but it is never too late to acknowledge the truth and to, you know, to let the truth be known. Whether it was by mistake at Garda headquarters, whether it was by error, whether it was by negligence, or whether the whole thing was intentional on the part of Garda authorities, an acknowledgement should be made that mistakes were made and that John Corcoran was needlessly murdered, because that's the kernel of the story. It was possible on at least two occasions to avoid any danger to him if they had taken action.
Let me put this point, because this is a very interesting thing when it comes to your story and what you're saying and the whole nature of the time, the nature of this brutal, vicious, secret, clandestine war that was going on. The MI5... secret agents, double agents, Sean O'Callaghan. I mean, there's been movies and books for plenty written about this, that somebody is dispensable or sacrificed in order to protect the more valuable informant, in order to, and I'm not in any way trying to justify it, but just trying to wrap my head around what might have happened to justify the protection of a greater source that saves more people or advances the causes of the state against the IRA or the UVF or the UD or whatever was going on there. And this was a horrendously murky, shadowy fog of war world that was going on, where informants were being, you know, sacrificed right throughout the time. Mistakes were being made, and yes, collusion by the state, certainly by the British state, as we still see, and still waiting answers in several of those instances as well, that all of that was going on, that may be what happened here. What's your response to someone who says, look, it was just, thank God those days are over, is what I'll say, but that might have what happened in this incident. It doesn't make it right. There was a family of 8 children that were left behind, but that it was, you know, he was a casualty of war, shall we say.
Yeah, when you say casualty of war, yes, I mean, that's one way of looking at it. I mean, people have said to me, you know, is this stake knife all over again, only this time in the Republic, in our own country?
Yeah.
I mean, with what I know What I personally know, what I know of John Corkran and his communication and his contact with Sean O'Callaghan and the dangers that put him under, okay? I mean, I just find it hard to deny that when I hear something like that. I find it hard to say, no, it's not like that at all. It stinks to high heaven.
And you feel it was wrong and it shouldn't have happened?
It need not have happened at all. It could have been avoided if my authorities had taken action and contacted me, brought me in and say, JP, stand down John Corkran. Everything would have been avoided. That man hopefully would still have been alive with his family. They did not do that.
Yeah, yeah. And JP, when you look at it now, we're still dealing, as I said, with, you know, the need for a truth and reconciliation process really here for the North, for those things that have happened. There are still some criminal prosecutions being pursued. There's the British government changed the legislation on that. That's still a matter of contention between the Irish and British state. The question asks, will we ever get to the truth of the things that happened? Things like John Corkran's murder and many others, do you think? Or do we have to keep striving for it?
I think the fight goes on to establish the truth. The truth is often hidden. Very often hidden for reasons to protect either other agents or to protect reputations of people in high places. And in my case, I'm pointing the finger directly at three of the top officers of the Garda Síochána. Their reputations were at stake here, and they are at stake, and I'm calling them out. And I think acknowledgement should be made that mistakes were made. People did not make decisions that they should have made. If they had done so, John Corkran would still be alive with his family. I think the state, the Garda Síochána commissioner, and I think the government should acknowledge at least that mistakes in this case were made and tell his family that.
Yeah.
Do the decent thing. Other institutions in Ireland have sinned against the state, as we all know. Yes. They have eventually come out. They've eventually come out with their hands up and admitted their wrongs. Why shouldn't the Garda Síochána do the very same?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
my question.
JP, finally, look, do you think, obviously, the peace process happened in 1998, and there's talks now of, obviously, a referendum eventually for a united Ireland. By and large, things are much more peaceful than there were. Are you thankful that those days are over? Do you think young people today will ever fully understand what you, people like John Corkran and others, and families went through north and south of the border from the Troubles?
I'm afraid they may not. No. History has shown us that young people, because of the mere fact that they haven't lived through it, they have no direct or personal knowledge of it. You know, they have to be educated and told about it. Who's going to tell them?
Yeah. Is that another reason why this inquiry needs to happen?
Yes.
And that is JP O'Sullivan, a retired Garda from Finnish, who has written a book called Veil of Silence. He was a special branch handler for John Corkran, a Republican informer for the Gardaí who was murdered in Kerry by the IRA in 1985. No one's ever been charged for his murder. And JP has written this book because he says not enough was done to save John Corkran and wants an inquiry into how senior Garda leadership handled the issue.